two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Hey, listeners. The Cost of Care is a 10-part series. We think it'll make more sense if you start from episode 1. So go back, start there, and we'll be here when you're ready.
Seeing that bill of $898,000, it just completely took my breath away. I was like, it was almost laughable. Like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, who can afford that?
In theory, health insurance is designed to protect us from the excessive cost of a medical catastrophe. But too often, patients find themselves stuck with the tab.
So our total bill was $1.7 million. What family in America could pay for something like that? And especially to go through such an ordeal and so many horrific things with my child and myself, like, why wouldn't they make an exception?
This is Lauren Bard. Back in 2018, she was hospitalized with complications during her pregnancy. Her daughter Sadie was born nearly 14 weeks premature.
She had 3 different holes in her heart. She had a blood transfusion. And I didn't hold her myself until she was almost about a month old because she was so tiny. And honestly, the first time seeing her, it was really surreal. It almost is fake when you see this little tiny baby that you're not used to seeing. You know, I'm reaching my hand into the incubator, and when it comes to preemies, you know, stimulation is a big thing for them. So a lot of times we can't even touch them. You just kind of have to place your hand on top.
But even as her newborn daughter fought to stay alive, another battle was looming in the distance.
Honestly, thinking about how much everything would cost did not even cross my mind. I was so worried about her and my own health, and that never even was a thought.
This is The Cost of Care. I'm your host, David Smith.
So I've lived in California all my life. Currently, I live in Norco, California. It's like a little horse town in Riverside County. And we have horse trails in front of our house, a bunch of livestock and all that. So if you hear roosters in the background, that's probably what it is. I have Sadie, who is now 2.5. She's our million-dollar baby I'll be talking about. And then I also have a 9-year-old son named Jace.
Lauren has been through a lot, so I was really surprised at how smiley and upbeat she was on our Zoom call. She's obviously a really strong, really resilient person, but in this understated, down-to-earth kind of way. And that might be because Lauren has spent her life helping others in their times of need.
I'm an ER nurse, and I've only worked at Dignity Health, so that's where I started out my career. I'm a charge nurse there.
Dignity Health is the 5th largest hospital system in the U.S. and the largest nonprofit hospital in Lauren's home state of California. As a seasoned nurse and mother who had experienced some issues with her first pregnancy, Lauren knew what to look out for.
When Sadie came along, I had blood pressure issues right from the get-go.
Her doctors weren't concerned until her 6-month checkup, when her blood pressure read 170 over 113. For those that don't know much about blood pressure readings, that's a dangerous level.
They're like, oh my gosh, you need to go to the ER right now. And I was in the hospital for 10 days. They were just trying to keep me pregnant for as long as possible.
But Lauren's blood pressure never stabilized. And as the risks mounted, her doctors decided they couldn't wait any longer. It was time to deliver Sadie.
I was 26 weeks and I had Sadie. She was 1 pound, 6 ounces at birth, was not breathing on her own. She had a lot of complications when she was first born. Within the first 2 days of her being born, they said she had a 50-50 chance of living because not only of her size, but she was also bleeding in her lungs because they were super underdeveloped. So she was hemorrhaging. Thankfully, she pulled through that, but she had to be intubated 4 different times within the first month of her life.
Tell me, Lauren, a little bit just about the NICU. What did the environment look like? How often were you able to visit her?
So since she was born, I was still a patient myself for 9 days. So I was in and out of going between the NICU and my room. So we were able to be there and kind of constantly go back and forth and visit her. So at least somebody was with her almost 24/7. But I would say the first 6 weeks for her was probably her most trying times. It was when we went through the most difficulty, when she had, you know, echocardiograms and she had laser eye surgery and she had, you know, just all these complications and things going wrong. In the other rooms, you're hearing when another baby is having difficulty or maybe needs to be intubated or something is going wrong. So you're hearing all that on top of all the alarms going off and bells. So Sadie loved to either go apneic, where she would stop breathing, or her oxygen levels would go really low. So you're just watching the monitor and seeing it like ding, 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 and it's getting louder and louder and louder as, you know, her levels go down.
How long was Sadie in the NICU?
I think it was 105 days. So like 3.5 months. So we spent a few holidays in there.
I literally can't imagine what would be going on in my head for 105. I don't know how you survived 105 days of that.
Yeah. You know, the nurses were always very real with us. Like, you know, they had to call us a couple times like, hey, I think you need to come in. Like, she's not really doing that well. So at least they helped prepare us for those kinds of situations and really involved us in the care for her. So I think that helped to know that we were included in making decisions and what was best. But honestly, just like the relationships with all her different care providers really kind of helped carry us through that hard time, you know, because you're going through so much and you're dealing with this new trauma of having a baby who's possibly going to die, or it's just a roller coaster in there, honestly.
By this point, Lauren is in total survival mode. But even while dealing with one health emergency after the other in the most chaotic environment imaginable, she still somehow found time to contact both her employer and her insurance company.
As soon as I went into the hospital, knowing that I was going to have to deliver her fairly soon, I obviously let my manager know what was going on and also had been talking to a nurse through Anthem Blue Cross. It's with a Future Moms program. So I had already been in contact with them and I had called to let them know that I was in the hospital and then also called when I had her. And then I spoke to a case manager from Anthem as well a few days after the birth to say, hey, you know, this is the situation, this is what's going on. She came here really early. So my insurance company was aware that she was born.
According to Lauren, Anthem assured her that she and the baby would be covered under her employee plan with Dignity. So she naturally turned her attention back to Sadie.
So a little over a month later, UC Irvine had said, hey, we're having some issues with trying to bill your insurance. You might want to contact them because we're having some discrepancies or some issues. So I called down to our benefit center through Dignity, and pretty much I get horrible news that I was 8 days too late of signing her up within that 31-day allotted period. Now, I was like, well, I had talked to the insurance. They know. And they're like, no, you didn't sign up through Dignity's website portal. And I was like, seriously? I was like, I didn't even know that I needed to do that. So apparently, as an employee, you have to sign up when there's a life event going on. And I have to register her on our website portal on top of contacting Anthem Blue Cross. So that you have to do both of those processes in order for her to be covered. And I didn't know I needed to do that.
So let's pause here in case you, like Lauren, consider yourself a pretty savvy person, but still got lost in the weeds just now. Basically, despite notifying Anthem Blue Cross and communicating with her supervisors at work, the coverage still did not take effect because she'd missed one small step that had only previously been mentioned in a Dignity Health employee handbook given to her 6 years earlier. By the time she realized the issue, the 31-day window to register her life event had closed.
And I tried to explain that there was extraordinary circumstances, like I was in the hospital myself and so much was going on. And they were very harsh and cold and were like, you know, you got the information when you were hired and you know the process of what needs to be done. So pretty much like you're kind of shit out of luck, honestly.
Coming up, we'll learn how Lauren fought back. Hey, listeners, we want to hear your stories. Have you been hit with a surprise bill after a procedure? Did you have a run-in with a healthcare system that felt infuriating or unfair? Or have you struggled to find in-network providers in your area? Share your story now by calling 833-4-LEMONADA. That's 833-453-6662. Or email us at costofcare@lemonadamedia.com.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, Season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. After spending over 3 months in the hospital, Sadie was finally able to go home. And life went back to normal, or as normal as life can really be with a newborn. But the fight for Sadie's coverage wore on. Lauren filed two appeals, one in November of 2018 and another in July of 2019, both of which were denied. Then, almost a year later, the bills arrived.
So they like slowly started rolling in. I think the first bill I ended up receiving was January or February of 2019. And it was like 500, and then it went to like 1,000, and then it was 70,000, and then I got another bill for the 898,000, and I kept getting them. So our total bill was $1.7 million.
So here's the thing. $1.7 million is an insane number to wrap your head around. But you might think to yourself, 105 days in the hospital with the level of care that she and Sadie needed, well, maybe $1.7 million is actually reasonable. But that's just how we've been conditioned to think about this stuff in America. Let's do the math on this. 105 days at $1.7 million comes out to $16,190 per day. That's not reasonable. And when you actually review the individual fees, you quickly remember how crazy it all is.
On the back, it breaks it down of all the costs of different things, like even just for the physician to put eyes on the patient. So they're just poking their head in, looking at the patient, that's $1,700. So each time, every day, multiple times a day, they're just looking at the patient, that's $1,700. And you'd think like, you know, she's on medications and oxygen and she's having procedures done like almost every day. So it's like kind of mind-blowing to see the breakdown and how much everything really truly costs.
What went on in your head when you got the bill for $898,000?
Honestly, it was just like I was in shock and I kind of just felt like numb because it like really sunk in as a reality, like, wow, I'm probably really going to have to owe this. And I really felt like if they're already going to deny it now, how is little me going to be able to win? And honestly, it was a lot. I mean, there were so many days of crying and like, I don't know, it was like just exhaustion and like you feel so helpless. So I knew I had to do something to just figure it out. And if that meant, you know, starting to talk to people about it, like friends and family, and seeing if there was, you know, some other kind of idea that somebody else could give me, you know, that's eventually where I came across getting in touch with Marshall.
The Marshall she's talking about is none other than our favorite top doctor, Marshall Allen, the ProPublica reporter we talked to back in episode 3. Lauren's story is featured in his new book, Never Pay the First Bill. Until he got involved, Lauren was getting the cold shoulder everywhere. She even tried shaming Dignity on Facebook by posting a photo of the bill. She got hundreds of comments and shares, but zero response from her employer.
Marshall was like, I'm going to reach out to Dignity Health's media team because I'm going to let them know we're going to write an article about this and it's probably not going to be very pretty. So I think it was a day or two after I got a call from the VP of operations for Dignity. And she called my cell phone. I'm like, okay. And she's like, hey, it's so-and-so. Like, I heard that you were going through this and, you know, we're gonna do what we can to fix it. Like, really? And she's like, yeah, you went through extraordinary circumstances. And I'm like, yeah, I was saying that in my appeals. But anyway, she was like, you know, we're going to get you in touch with the case manager with Anthem and we're going to retroactively cover it. Like, now? Because you were going to get a bad rap? Because somebody was going to tell the real truth of the story of what Hello Human Kindness Dignity Health did to their own employee? Like, that's what breaks my heart, that they didn't reach out because they saw a problem. It was because it was gonna make them look bad.
Quick thing, Hello Human Kindness is Dignity Health's motto. We'll get to the irony of that in just a minute, but here's the thing that gets me about Lauren's story. who knows what would have happened if she hadn't connected with a journalist who had the power to publicly shame her employer. Probably what happens to a lot of people in this country. They go broke. And that possibility kept Lauren up at night.
I've worked so hard at getting to where I'm at today. You know, I was a single mom for a while with my son. I went through nursing school and I bought my own home, but literally everything would be taken away from me. I'd have to file bankruptcy. My home would probably be taken away. Like all those things where I did my due diligence. I did everything that I could or that I knew I could do. So that was like a harsh reality to kind of swallow, to be like, wow, like I might lose everything.
You've used the term helpless a few times as we've been talking. What does helplessness feel like in this situation?
I think it was really hard when I would talk to people on the phone, like you're pouring your heart out to them and nobody's really listening. It's just very frustrating. Sorry, I don't want to get emotional, but it's a lot to deal with. You have to be very mentally strong. I do have to say we have a great community of people around us. And family and friends who are super supportive and, you know, prayed for us and even donated money to us when we were in the NICU for so long. it was a lot.
Dignity's motto is "Hello, human kindness."
Yes.
When you got your job at Dignity and you marched in on your first day, proud about this big, exciting place you were joining, and you saw those words, what did you feel then about that motto? And then now, as you look back and you think about "Hello, human kindness," and you think about the experience you had, how do you view that motto now?
Oh, man. It definitely made me jaded about it. It's a little sore spot for me. But, you know, if you read our mission, you know, we're a Catholic hospital. So we actually do have sisters there. And, you know, we're supposed to care for patients through the healing ministry of Christ. You know, treating patients with respect and dignity and just giving them excellent care. And that's what we honestly try and do as much as we can. So I feel like as just as much care and heart and blood, sweat, and tears that I put into the company for the 6 years at that time, that of course they would help out an employee. Why wouldn't they? I'm one of their own charge nurses that runs the ER. It wasn't even a thought in my mind that they wouldn't try and help me out when I reached out to them initially. And for them to be so hesitant and unwilling to help was a real slap in the face.
When we got off the line with Lauren, I had to cancel the next 2 hours of my day. Like I even tried to get on my next call, and 5 minutes in, I just said, like, I can't do this right now. And it happened to time with when my kids got home from school, and I just could not stop crying after hearing Lauren's story. And I think it was certainly because Lauren, the humanness of Lauren's experience was something that I think any parent can identify with, even if her experience was so far beyond anything I've ever lived. But the other thing that I was just indignant about was that I've worked with both of the companies Lauren described. I know people at those companies. I know executives. I've had dinners and drinks with these people, and they're not bad people. And yet at the same time, I know that story typifies what those two companies do as a function of just normal practice in this industry. And it sucks. It was a reminder to me of why I'm doing the work I'm doing. It's because Lauren's story is not just some outlier. It's not just some random thing that happened that we found that makes for really good podcast tape. It happens everywhere, every day, constantly, all the time. And when you hear about the profound impact it had on her, her psyche, her family, she weathered it, but a lot of people don't. But regardless of the human toll, in this case, the system did exactly what the system is designed to do. After the break, we sit down with a public health expert to figure out how we can build a better system and actually hold bad actors accountable.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And we would like to invite you on a hilarious and heartfelt journey each week on The Deep Dive. From navigating the chaos of motherhood and family to exploring the depths of grief and loss, we are just two best friends who process life together and with you guys. Discover our secrets to finding joy amidst the madness and get ready for unfiltered conversations about life, love, and everything in between. And nails. We talk a lot about nails. Now, community is everything to us at The Deep Dive. We believe in the power of connection and the strength that comes from supporting one another, and we would love to have you with us. So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
So during all of Lauren's interview, I kept having this image come back to my head over and over. And it was an image of me being at this conference a few years ago. And an executive from Dignity is on the stage with four other people. And I notice he's wearing a $2,000 pair of men's Louboutin shoes. He looked like $1 million. And being on the stage, he's talking about all the things that they're doing for vulnerable communities and all the things that they're doing to engage their patients in dignified ways and the progressive care that they're providing for patients. And then when I hear this mission statement thing of, hello, human kindness, and I look at that juxtaposition, it just makes me kind of sick to my stomach. I'm not saying in any way that the man on this panel is a bad person, that he's complicit in Lauren's story. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with wearing a $2,000 pair of shoes. I have nice shoes. What I am saying is that the words this person was saying in this conference does not match the experience of an employee of that institution. And that kind of dissonance between executives who seem to believe they're doing one thing and the reality of what's going on the ground happens everywhere. Stories like Lauren's piss me off, but they say so much about the system. So to calm down and dig into it, I turned to Dr. Ashish Jha. He's a physician and dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University. And through the pandemic, he's become a go-to source for public health wisdom. Ashish is consistently one of the clearest and most cathartic sources on my TV. So I sat down with him, took a deep breath, and discussed what happens when the good intentions of nonprofit hospitals are put to the test. So across the country, most of our country's hospitals are nonprofit. And I, you know, for a decade, I have sat in board meetings and senior leadership team meetings. And there's always this defense. Like, I have heard this 1,000 times, no margin, no mission. So the justification for this is, well, David, we got to make money. Otherwise, we can't do the mission-based things that we want to do. Do you believe that hospitals, that the nonprofit entities at the provider level, are they motivated by mission? Are they motivated by community prestige and position and posture? Like, what is the driving force behind a nonprofit's ambitions, aspirations?
Yeah, so, you know, there are, 4,000 nonprofit hospitals, who have about 80% of all the hospitals out there. And they vary, right? They vary in their motivations. But here's the biggest picture point I would make. One is the nonprofit hospitals, they make a lot of nonprofits every year. Technically those aren't profits, but they're making a lot of money and their margins are often very, very good. But because they can't, because they're not for profit, they can't make the same kind of payouts. So what they do is they find ways of spending it. So their margins always look pretty thin. And so people are like, oh, hospitals run on a 1% to 2% margin. But the truth, of course, is hospitals, I mean, not all of them, and during crises like the one we're in now, they can struggle. But hospitals generally over the last decade have done extremely well financially. And that money comes from somewhere, and it's, you know, and but that money is flowing into the healthcare system, and hospitals are doing well, their executives are doing well. And I get the no margin, no mission. We don't think that hospitals will do well if they're, like, losing money. But if the question that is asked is, nonprofit has a huge societal cost, right? Because these people are not then paying taxes. So the question that is in front of us is the nonprofit status justified? And I would say for a vast majority of hospitals, absolutely not. They do not generate enough community value, societal value, to justify. And they would be better off, and everybody would be better off, if they were just for-profit. They act like for-profit institutions. They go after poor people who can't pay for their bills like for-profit institutions would. They should just become for-profit and pay your taxes. And I think it would be better. I think it would be a lot more transparent. I actually think the nonprofit status, not of all, there are definitely hospitals that do incredible amounts of community service and are terrific. But the nonprofit status of a lot of these places are certainly not justified.
So what would happen if we just took away the nonprofit status of many of these hospitals? Would it actually make anything better if those hospitals are still just charging exorbitant prices?
Yeah, it helps in two ways. One is those hospitals now start paying taxes. And so all of a sudden you can improve the tax base of that community. You can actually start doing things like investing more in social determinants from those tax dollars that maybe can improve the health of the community and reduce healthcare utilization. So there are those direct benefits, but I think the politics of what I'm laying out is probably not feasible, workable. So I think that would be better for society, be better for those communities. But there's going to be a lot of pushback from hospitals because nobody likes to pay taxes. And they're going to claim that they're going to have to lay off people. And remember, most of these hospitals are often the largest employer in any congressional district. And all of that is going to drive the politics of this to go in a different direction. I mean, there are nonprofits who do terrific community service. And so I don't know that I want all of them to be forced into being for-profit, because that, I think, would be bad. But what I want is very clear metrics on what constitutes community benefit, and then a real rigorous evaluation of every hospital, certainly every large hospital, to demonstrate that it is actually generating enough community benefit to justify its tax-exempt status. It's sort of like, imagine, David, that you're paying me nothing to be part of this podcast, but imagine I said, you know, I charge $5,000 an hour. Not actually, but let's just say. And I'm donating this to you, so I am going to write $5,000 off on my taxes for doing this podcast. Like, that would be brilliant, except it's nonsense. And by the way, I'm obviously not going to do that. But it's that kind of stuff, right? It's that kind of stuff where you're like, come on.
For the record, an hour with Dr. Jha might actually be worth $5,000. But also, thank God he's kidding. The sad thing about this joke is that it's not that far from reality. Just think of Lauren getting charged $1,700, basically every time the doctor popped in and said hello. These insane fees are at the root of our American system, and it's something Ashish has studied extensively. The first time I got introduced to your work, somebody forwarded me one of your PowerPoint decks when you were at Harvard. And your deck makes the argument that in American healthcare, we don't have a utilization problem, we have a price problem. Can you break that down
sure.
a bit?
Absolutely. Yeah, so for a long time, I mean, we've known that America spends a lot more on healthcare than all other major industrialized countries. And there are all sorts of theories about why that is and what the explanation is. And what I have really been struck by is how deeply ingrained these narratives are. And so a few years ago, my colleague Irene Papanicolaou and I decided that it was really important to go back and look at the work that Uwe Reinhardt had done more than 20 years ago in a paper entitled, "It's the Price is Stupid." But now we had a lot better data across all these high-income countries. So we wanted to really break down, what is it that explains higher healthcare spending in America? And basically what we found is that Americans don't consume much more healthcare than other people. They use about the same amount, maybe even a touch less than a lot of other high-income countries. But their unit prices are much, much higher. We pay more for pharmaceuticals. We pay more for doctors. We may pay more for nurses, CAT scans. Everywhere you look, we pay more for each service. We also have higher administrative costs. And you put that together, and that's why our healthcare spending is so much higher.
So let's dig into that just a little bit. What do you believe is driving those unit costs? Like, what are the biggest culprits?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is it's everywhere in the healthcare system. So our CAT scans are 2 to 3 times what CAT scans in Switzerland cost. Now, if you've ever been to Switzerland, you know it's not a cheap country, right? It's like everything in Switzerland is super expensive, except their CAT scans are half our price. And so if you take just that and say, well, how could that be? Is it that our doctors are better than the Swiss doctors? Like, I don't know, probably not that much better. But our doctors get paid more than Swiss doctors do. So that's a big part of the explanation. Weak government, ineffective markets, welcome to prices in America.
So Americans aren't consuming twice as much healthcare as everyone else. They're just paying twice as much for it. And you would think, well, there's a lot of us patients and only a few of these big hospital systems. Shouldn't we be able to leverage that purchasing power? Well, this goes back to something Ashish said a little earlier. These hospital systems and insurance companies are often the biggest employer in a congressional district. And so they have a ton of political leverage. So instead of getting a seat at the bargaining table, patients are stuck in the middle of a tug of war between what hospitals want and what insurance companies want. Fundamentally, the insurance company's preference would be that patients were healthy, they didn't need to use a lot of care, and they didn't have to pay out a lot of claims, primarily the latter two. The provider does really well when there's heads in beds and when people are there. And for a head to be in a bed, there needs to be a medical event or situation, which means one part of the system tends to thrive on sickness and illness, and one part of the system will thrive on an absence of sickness or illness. That's a pretty fundamental misalignment.
It is. And there's no doubt about it that insurance companies, their motivation is keep people out of the hospital, keep people out of doctor's offices, keep people out of the emergency room, largely because that keeps medical claims low. And obviously, if emergency rooms are sitting empty, it's hard for hospitals to make any money. Everybody is focused on trying to do their part. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That's literally how markets work. The issue is that when you don't have a whole lot of competition and you don't have the right set of market forces, it doesn't land you where you want to be in terms of optimizing consumer outcomes or spending.
This is what makes Lauren's story so important. It's the tug of war in action. Her doctors were there to give Sadie the best care. The hospital was there to charge as much for that care as possible. And then her employer was doing everything in their power to avoid getting stuck with the bill. According to Marshall's ProPublica reporting, Dignity Health self-funds their benefits, so they're on the hook for bills like Sadie's. And even though they reported $6.6 billion in net assets in 2018 and pay their CEO roughly $12 million a year, when it comes to paying for patient claims, they're a little less generous. But here's the thing about the tug of war between insurance companies and providers. It's a long game. In episode 3, we talked about the complicated, convoluted process behind medical coding. Well, it takes time to parse through all those claims and figure out who will and won't pay. And in the midst of the administrative back and forth, the patient is usually the one left holding the bag when the dust settles. And don't forget, every single one of us funds this system that's rigged against us with our premiums and our tax dollars and our co-pays. And then nearly every attempt to reform the system ends up falling on our shoulders too.
Policy solutions that often come, like try to tweak one part of it in a small way, and it has not moved the needle. So right now we've tried things like, what if we put consumers into high deductible health plans? Maybe that will create the financial incentive for them to be good consumers and make smart decisions. Theoretically, right? I don't think it's wrong. The problem with it is if you only have information about your prices, but you don't have alternative choices, and you don't have quality information, and you don't have any sense of what the payoff of is on value of these various services, you won't be surprised that consumers won't make excellent choices. You don't fix a wholly broken market by tweaking one part of it. The whole thing you need choices, you need good data on quality, you need good data on value, and you often need somebody to help people navigate these things. And without all of that, we've just thrown people into high deductible health plans and we say, now they have an incentive, let's see if the consumers can do it. And then when they can't, we say, people can't be consumers in healthcare, markets don't work. And I'm like, I'm not sure we really tried it, but okay.
Right. We can't say that markets don't work, but we can definitely confirm that the current one is totally broken. Why? Normal markets function at their best when everyone has the same information, when all the stakeholders share aligned incentives. But those things don't exist in America's healthcare market. That's why healthcare is not a normal market. And markets that aren't normal can't drive competition or efficiently allocate resources, like, say, $4 trillion worth of resources. And when a market becomes this dysfunctional, it hurts all of us.
There's families across the country who have been in my situation and haven't been so lucky to come out on the positive end of it and have lost everything.
Today, Lauren has enough distance from this experience that she's just grateful to have Sadie, who she can now affectionately call her $1 million baby.
You're back, puppy dog.
Sadie, she's our little firecracker. She's super loud and outspoken. You would, I mean, as a baby, she was always like very quiet. And now she's just off the charts, super independent, wants to do things her way, but very feisty. And, you know, she definitely completes our family.
Lauren will be the first person to tell you that the doctors and nurses at UC Irvine saved her daughter's life and were there for her and her family during their darkest hour. The question is, should that ordeal come along with a $1.7 million price tag? And should your employer be the middleman between you and your doctors? So far, we've looked at how the system doesn't work for patients. Next week, we're talking about providers to see how the current model is leaving them burned out and powerless too.
It's surprising to many people who aren't in the field, but even before COVID, the national rate of burnout among physicians was 40-45%. And I think that's because they aren't really, doctors today aren't able to practice the way they really want to practice. You know, who became a doctor just to do paperwork? No one.
The Cost of Care is a Lemonada original. The show is produced by Jackie Danziger and Keegan Zema. Our associate producer is Julia Yort. Music is by Hannes Brown. Executive producers are Stephanie Whittles-Wax, Jessica Cordova-Kramer, and David Smith. Help others find our show by leaving us a rating and writing a review. If you have a story to share, call us at 833-4-LEMONADA or send us an email at costofcare@lemonadamedia.com. Follow us at Lemonada Media across all social platforms or find me on Twitter at CHI David Smith. Lastly, we want to express our appreciation for the men and women who get up every day and work in the system with a passion for improving our health. We are grateful for the work you do. We'll be back next week.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.